Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is the penultimate episode before 100. This is episode 99 of Registry Matters. Larry, happy Saturday. How are you?
Well, thank you, sir. I am doing okay, I guess, for being approaching 180, my 180th birthday this year.
You are definitely old, and you are certainly a curmudgeon.
That's right.
You're an old cranky bastard. That's all I got to say. But you are the expert on all things. Larry, your expertise extends far past just knowing about the registry and all those things, but your strategy, your skills in all these departments is just really, I'm beyond words, honestly, as to how to describe what your skill set is here.
Well, I appreciate that. The check is in the mail.
That's why I send you all the money. That's exactly why I send you all the money.
But I do have a curmudgeon story. You remember? I remember when I was looking at phones the other day.
Yes. So let me replay your story and you fill in the gaps. You are at the store getting a phone because you don't like your new phone. And there's a 17-year-old telling you how the law works?
That would be correct. and more importantly, he was telling me about sexual offense laws.
And that anything with more than a 4-year age difference is no-no?
That's what he said. But to make the story funnier, he had already gotten on my nerves because of I have these little buttons that he pushed right away when I was asking him about phones, and he was not really wanting to spend a lot of time with me. I guess he had his phone he'd rather be on. And he told me that if I could pick a phone, that he'd be happy to activate one. And I didn't know enough to pick a phone. And I was asking him various questions, and he answered a couple of times, "It's up to you." And I get irritated. I said, "Of course, everything is up to me. I'm the customer. If right. I buy a particular phone, it's up to me." I said, "I don't know why you need to say that. That goes without saying, it's up to me." And it's kind of like when you say thank you, they say no problem. Who the heck said there was a problem? No problem after someone says thank you is not the response. It's like that. That's another pet peeve of mine. When I say thank you, they say no problem. Who the hell said there was a problem?
Larry, you are a difficult human, man. You are straight up a difficult human.
Well, I mean, think about that. Thanks. No problem. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at phones. I told myself, "Well, just let me do some reading. I'm independent. And if I need you, I'll get back to you." And he finally peers back over the side of the booth. I was in the center of the Coronado Mall, at one of those, what do you call those island booths they have?
Kiosks.
Kiosk. Yeah, he was on one side, and I was on the other. And he comes back over and said, "You decide anything?" I said, "No, I think I'm going to reserve this for another day." And I was trying to strike up some small talk, and there was a girl working in one of the shops directly across there. And I said, "Well, at least you have a good job. You get to play on your phone, play games, and then you have nice views here of customers, in particular nearby shops." And he picked up right away what I was talking about. He said, "She's too old." And I said, "She's what?" He said, "She's too old." And I said, "Too old for what?" And I said, "What do you mean?" Because, you know, she looked very young as far as I'm concerned. And he looked
young. That's because you're 150, whatever, 250 years old.
And I said, "So she's too old for what?" He says, "Well, I couldn't even have anything to do with her because she's too old." And I said, "Well, tell me about this. She's too old in what way?" He says, "Well, she's more than 4 years older than me." And I said, "Really?" And I said, "You're at least 16, aren't you? You had a beard." And I thought he was up like 20, 21 at least. And he said, "I'm 17. And I said, "Well, you're of the age of consent." He said, "No." He said, "You're not right about that." He said, "You have to be 18. I said, "Really?" I said, "I thought that had to do with if you had a position of authority or supervisory, if you had any type of control over the minor." I said, "But other than that, I always thought it was 16. I'm not playing any of my cards at that point." I said, I thought it was 16. He said, "Oh, no." He said, "Everybody knows the age of consent is 18. I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "And then," he said, even that was the case, he said, "If I was 18, he said, doesn't matter. He said, "She's 4 years older than me." And I said, "More than 4 years." I said, "Really?" I said, "I thought that 4 year age gap applied to people who were, it's protecting teenagers who have sex with teenagers. We protect the people who are under 16 in the state so they can have relations with someone consensual as long as there's not more than a 4 year gap." and therefore the person who's 4 years or less won't be prosecuted. And I said, I always thought, he said, oh, no. He said, I said, so let me get this straight. I said, as old as I am, I thought I could have sex with anybody who was over the age of consent. And he said, nope, 4 years. I said, so I have to pick someone who's 4 years, within 4 years of my age? And he said, yes. He said, everybody knows that. And I said,
everybody knows it.
And I said, well, at that point, I'm going to play my cards. And I said, well, I just want you to know that I actually do teach this stuff. I said, I'm recognized as an expert by courts in New Mexico, and I teach attorneys this stuff. And I said, you're just not correct on the law. And I said, but that's all right. I said, it's better for you to be safe than sorry. I said, so, you know, treat it cautiously. But he was lecturing me on the law.
Now, granted, I realize that this would have been something that would have been enacted later, but my parents are 6 years apart. So, I mean, like, they would be in trouble.
Under his version of the law, yes.
And what, Hugh Hefner, Donald Trump, I mean, like, you can come up with scores and scores of examples where it's not just like 4, maybe 5, 6, 7 years. Trump is like 20 years older than Melania.
Well, and then Ed McMahon, who, if people remember The Tonight Show, was the sidekick of Johnny Carson.
Yes.
He was like 70 years old, and he had a child, and I forget how young the wife was, but it was quite a bit younger. I mean, decades younger. And so yes, it was fascinating, entertaining, but I left it at that and told him that I appreciated his information, but it wasn't quite right.
Well, Larry, for the breaking news, we have an update on the Georgia situation, and then there's an update from the Pennsylvania Superior Court on internet publication stuff. Let's start with the Georgia update. What can you tell me about what's going on in Georgia?
Well, I can tell you that two lawsuits, I think we've touched on it in previous episodes, two lawsuits have been filed in the United States District Court, two different districts, because of the setup in Georgia. They have three districts. So we have a case in the Northern District, which covers the county of Spalding, and we have a case in the Middle District, which covers the county of Butts. The Spalding County officials decided that they were not going to put the signs up in 2019, so therefore the injunction request was really mooted by their action. You no longer have an emergency situation. So that case is on the back burner. It didn't go away because they didn't agree that and settled, saying that they would never do it again. They said they weren't going to do it in 2019. In Butts County, Sheriff Gary Long has decided that he's going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court if he has to.
Did he say that?
That's what he said, that he's going
to
take.
Oh, my God. I didn't know about the Supreme Court part.
So we had a hearing on the injunction Thursday, and then yesterday the parties were ordered to prepare briefs from each side and submit them by 5 p.m. They were done. The briefs were submitted yesterday, and I've read the briefs, and the decision is pending, and I anticipate a decision prior to Halloween. I can't tell you what day the court's going to issue the decision. I can tell you that the later that they issue it, the better it is for us in case we get the injunction, because there's less time for the county to appeal to the 11th Circuit. We had observers in the courtroom. We had at least two that I know of, and I think you know one of the observers. So,
I know both of them, actually, and I know one of them incredibly well.
And I think you could tell us in terms of your observations of how the hearing went down in a couple minutes synopsis. I think you told me you felt pretty positive about the hearing. So let's hear what your observations were.
Let me ask you this. I'll ask you this up front. To me, it seems that the whole thing is hinging upon this idea of what is the quote unquote right of way. And whatever the stand, wherever it comes from, they're saying that it's 30 feet from the center line of the highway. So, you know, maybe the road is, I think, like 12 or 15 feet wide. So then you would have another 10, 15 feet on the other side into the property that is not yours. And I've kind of always known that this existed, but you take care of it. If you don't take care of it, someone's going to come thump you on the forehead and say, you need to take care of it. So it's like, it's yours, but it's not yours. And I'm really, to me, it seems the whole thing hinges on how the judge feels about what do they call the right of way. Do you have any input on that concept?
I don't know enough about what would constitute right of way. I don't think the decision's going to turn on that. I really don't, because that is really a irrational argument. By that standard, the sheriff could go put signs for his reelection in front of your house and say, "I'm the greatest sheriff," and it's in front of your yard, and that would imply that you endorsed that candidate, and you couldn't take it down because it's on the right of way. That's crazy.
And then they brought up the Alabama driver's license debacle, and from that, there are four standards that they have to meet to prove compelled speech, and you know, here's a government document. It is directly associated with you. It has a message that you didn't agree to. And I don't remember what all the four things were. And the judge was explicitly making the comparison. He's like, I don't care about the right of way necessarily, but here's a sign. It doesn't say you're a quote unquote registrant, but it says, you know, this is a dangerous person living here. Now, where Long may have screwed up is last year he made a Facebook post saying, I'm putting these signs in front of these people's yards to identify them as these kind of people. So he made the association. That is where I was like, oh, this is what the judge is going to rule on. He's going to, because regardless of even if it's on the other side of the street pointing, or even if it's like at the neighbor's houses pointing towards your house, they are still totally associating that message with you. And to me, I felt like that's where it was going to go.
Well, there's so many arguments in this case that the county's making. They're claiming they were voluntary. And in fact, in their briefing, they said in their final closing brief, they said it was proffered that maybe they should ask the registrants if they would voluntarily post these signs and have them sign a waiver saying that they would do that. And I'm just betting if you go and say, look, you ain't required to do this and no penalty will befall you, but we'd like you to post this. I'm betting there won't be very many takers. What do you bet?
I can just about guarantee you that nobody would say, yep, that's where we should be. That's what we should do.
There'd be one person that would be a sex offender named Jake Goldenflame who used to go out campaigning to keep a close eye on sex offenders, and he was one himself. And but other than Jake Goldenflame, I don't think anybody in the right mind would want a sign put in their yard that identified them as a sex offender, even though it doesn't say sex offender. Everybody knows that the signs are in front of the sex offenders' yards.
And another part that I thought was interesting was where they said that this is government property and you can't do anything to modify it, remove it, you know, anything like that. And someone said, well, could someone take a trash can and put it on top of it? Because now you're not removing it or violating it, you're just making it so it can't be displayed. But so that right of way area would be used for a speed limit sign. Okay. And I was like, man, I don't know how you thread that needle of like, you know, that's carrying the government's message per se.
So, but that's speed limit signs are never in a person's yard.
They're not on the right of way in front of someone's house ever?
Well, I've never seen one in my yard.
Not necessarily your yard, but like in your neighborhood.
I've never seen one in anyone's yard.
There are speed limit signs in your neighborhood, Larry, in front of somebody's house.
Yes, but they're not in the yard itself. They're in the area we refer to as a setback. There's an area between the street, and then there's some dirt, and then there's a sidewalk, and they're usually in that dirt setback area between the street and the sidewalk. But as far as being over in someone's yard, I don't think I can ever recall seeing a sign in someone's yard.
Okay. And then the final point that I wanted to bring up is the way that the sheriff presented the argument that, well, could you get enough deputies to go sit in front of everybody's houses? He goes, well, yeah, I mean, this would effectively do the same thing, but the sign method is more efficient. And that made me think about the Supreme Court case with the GPS stuff where they said, hey, we're just going to put this GPS tracker on somebody's car. And because that's more efficient than doing, you know, boots on the ground, following somebody from point to point to log all their places. I'm sorry. You don't get the privilege of having it be more efficient. You have to exercise some level of resources to do your job.
Well, beyond that, they have no right to sit in front of people's house and interfere with trick-or-treating. You have the right in the state of Georgia to hand out candy, to be polite, to enjoy the costumes, to admire the people, to engage with them. There is no law, Sheriff Long. You have no right to do this. It might be a good idea in your mind, but you didn't get legislative approval. And when you do get legislative approval, which is exactly where this is headed, this is going to go to the legislature, and they're going to try to pass a law, and we're going to do everything we can to kill it, and then we're going to challenge it in the constitution of that. But
you have no right, and that never came up in the argument. You might not like to see sex offenders having someone, kids knock at their door. That's not your prerogative as sheriff to like or dislike that. It's not unlawful for them to knock at the door and hand out candy. That's where you're a nut, Sheriff Long. You're a complete certifiable nut.
So, yeah, that's the George, that was at the hearing. It was very, I'm always fascinated by going into that environment, Larry. I really am. It's neat, watching the jousting. I like debates. I just do. Call me crazy.
Well, which way is the court going to rule?
I think I would have to say it's like 50-50, but I'm inclined to lean that we're victorious.
Well, we'll find out between Monday and Wednesday.
And then what's the update with Ben Hill County?
Ben Hill County is another county, a relatively small county. The county seat would be Fitzgerald. In fact, it's a little bit southwest of you, I think. But it's certainly south of you. But southeast. They announced that they're going to be doing Halloween signs. So NARSL did Ben Hill County a favor. We sent them the same letter that we sent to these two counties last year, cautioning them not to do that. And anybody affiliated with the sheriff's apparatus or law enforcement apparatus in Georgia is listening. We're being nice to you. We're telling you we are going to sue you too next year. We probably won't get you sued this year. So you'll get to have your fun this year. But we're going to take a poll of all the registrants in Ben Hill County and find out what happened. And we will, unless we lose these lawsuits, we're coming after you, Ben Hill County, and any other county in Georgia that wants to stand up and do this. We're ready for you. We've got a cookie cutter complaint ready, and we're going to come at you, and we're going to put an end to this nonsense in the state of Georgia. I mean, I'm sorry, you don't get to make up your own laws and do what you want to do. You put on that badge and you put your hand on that Bible and you swore you would uphold the law. You're not a lawmaker. And if you don't like the law, there's a process for you to seek change of law. But the law doesn't permit you to do this, and we're going to shut you down.
I will tell you one thing about that county, Ben Hill County. I was about 20 minutes away, and my phone went completely dark. No signal. I have two SIM cards on my phone, so I have two phone numbers, and both sets of towers. I have T-Mobile and AT&T. Dead. Nothing. They are so far out in the sticks of nothing. I don't know how anybody survives in a county like that. There can't be any reasonable jobs. I don't know how that works.
Oh, it is in the boonies, but I think 17,000 is the population of the county. So they probably have 30, 40 people registered.
Yeah. I know that in Butts County, they were saying 57 were registrants, and Butts might be a big county, but the population of Jackson is not very big.
Butts is a little over 20,000. And the number of offenders is somewhat distorted because the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Intake Center for the prisoners who are going into Georgia prisons is in Butts County.
Well, the 57 was excluding those folks.
Yes. And I was going to say the number looks a lot larger than what it really is, because if you pull down the list, they have all the people who are in the prison on there. But those people are not reporting into the sheriff.
I understand. And then let's move on over to Pennsylvania, since our update is taking forever. But let's go over there real quick.
Well, we actually did a deep dive rather than just doing a highlight. This case, we can do a little bit more of a deep dive later. But the Pennsylvania Superior Court issued a decision yesterday or the day before, very recently, that internet publication is a violation of the ex post facto clause. And although it's a really good decision, it is narrow, and it's very narrow because you have to have been a pre-2012 for this apply to you. This is an as applied ruling, and it's not the highest tribunal in the state, but it is a very important, very good decision, and we can dig into it a little bit later. But as I cautioned when the case of Menendez came down, I said, and I got chastised for saying this, that the legislature will do their best to reinstate registration and go as far as they can to test the limits of how far they can go, because laws are presumed constitutional. So they reinstated the internet publication when they passed enactments in 2018 in response to the Supreme Court decision and the Menendez decision. And now one small part of that has been stricken. And I don't expect this to end, and I know I'm not supposed to say this because it really drives people bananas, but I expect them to try one more time. They're not going to stop trying to have internet publication and just throw in the towel. It's not my desired outcome, but I expect that they will try. They will possibly ask the Supreme Court to review this decision. And then if they get the same outcome they got in Muniz, then they'll probably go back to the legislature and probably try to craft a slightly narrow application of the internet and make sure it doesn't apply to everybody and see how far they can go. That's what legislators do, and that's what they're likely to do. But that is not what I prefer they do.
I think you like it when people chastise you.
Well, it's funny because they say I never say anything positive. And I said, well, okay, well, I can tell. Okay, they're going to throw in the towel. There won't be any more. The registry is going to go away tomorrow. And of course, nobody in their right mind believes that. But I think that they're going to continue to fight. They're not going to want to let go of the internet publication. I mean, I'm not saying that we're not going to eventually win this. I think eventually we are going to win this in terms
of
the internet.
It does seem like a pretty far stretch. I mean, the way that, you know, when it started in, you know, whatever, the Alaska stuff. And, man, everybody relies on the internet for everything. To have your junk just posted out there is certainly beyond what anybody else has to go through. So now you've just got this one little group of people that have their junk published.
Yes, indeed. But most registries, when they started, the internet hadn't even evolved to the point where there was an internet database. It wasn't until the late 90s that they started illuminating everybody on the registries.
Moving on to a question from our new patron, John. We had a pretty big, thorough question from him last week. And he gave a little bit of a follow-up, I guess this would be. He says, I know according to the textualist view of a civil regulatory scheme, the registration liability is completely universal that one must register if convicted of a sex offense. But what is Larry's living constitutional view of someone who is not required to register in the jurisdiction of their conviction, but must register elsewhere when told? I guess that's somebody moving from state A to state B, and then they have a registration requirement in state B. Is that what he's asking?
I think that's what he's trying to ask, but he's not very succinctly asking that question, which makes us have to guess at what he's asking. There are some states that have in their registration statute that if you have to register anywhere, you have to register there. But not by all means. States don't have that clause in there. Just because you have to register, that starts with a false premise. What happens is that different states have different periods of where they cover what they consider a covered sex offender, and they have different offense lists. Some cover more offenses than others.
Listuses is a word, Larry.
So it's all individualized to that state. It's back to my automobile example that I give repeatedly. If mm-hmm. you take your exempt vehicle from a state where you don't have to do an emissions inspection, where they're more lenient, in particular the arid western states where there's not a lot of people and air quality is not generally a problem, and you take it to a more densely populated northeastern corridor where there's a lot denser population and air quality is potentially a bigger problem, the fact that you're exempt from registering an emission inspecting your car is of no relevance to New Jersey. They could care less. And so when you have a registration obligation that ends in Georgia because Georgia removes you, as long as the state that you go to has a registry scheme that hasn't been declared punishment and unconstitutional, if they have a different definition, they can wind up that clock all over again. They can say, well, you did your time in Georgia on the registry. You met their civil obligations. You haven't met your civil obligations here. We have a 25-year period of time. You were only on the registry 7 years. And in fact, we don't even give credit for the 7 years you were on in Georgia before you got off. So therefore, you'll have to register for at least 25 years while you're here. And I don't think the Constitution comes into play here, whether it's textualist or evolving. I don't see the correlation there, because until a particular state's registration scheme is declared unconstitutional because it's punishment, they can apply it to a person retroactively. They can alter the terms as long as they don't increase the terms to the point like some states have done, where those increases, those enhancements have amounted to punishment. Michigan, Pennsylvania, some states have done that, and they've been slapped down by their courts. But I'm really struggling with where he's trying to go with the question. I don't think that the living or the textualist view has anything to do with this issue. It has to do with whether the state's registry has been proven to be punishment or not. And if it has been, you may not have to register if you have an older conviction and they say that they can't apply these enhanced requirements to you because your conviction is too old. You may be home free, but otherwise a person may have to register despite the fact they've been removed from another state.
And then we could try and go down the path where the guy moved to North Carolina. This was probably a year ago that we talked about this. The guy moved to North Carolina and he goes into the office and says, do I have to register? And they go, no. And then he moves to a new county and he asks again. And then they said yes. And then he got messed up for not registering. But they would have never known he was there had he not shown up in the office.
I think he went in twice to the Wake County office. He went in. He just couldn't let go of the fact that there's people out there that just cannot accept the fact they don't have to register.
Larry, to be fair, it is someone does not want to get jammed up for not following the rules appropriately, and they don't trust that they're going to get jammed up for not following the rules.
I understand the fear. It is there. But when I ask people to show me the prosecutions for this, I can never get anyone to show me one. There's theoretically you could be 72 hours and 1 minute in a state, and they could prosecute you if they have that clause. I have not been provided with any evidence that I'm on the national and the state criminal defense lawyers listserv, and I have never had a case like that come to me. Now, I have had cases where people have actually moved to the state, not being temporarily present, but moved to the state, and they're like past the 3 days and they've gotten prosecuted because the state that they moved from notified them and they gave them the address of where they said they were going to, and they didn't make it in within the period of time. And I have heard of those, but where a person who's actually just been driving through a state and I have never heard. So yes, the fear is there, but there's just because you have the fear doesn't make it realistic, does it?
No, absolutely not. And I've shared before, man, this is within a handful of months of me getting out. And so my boss made special arrangements to fly into Atlanta. I picked him up. Then we drove south. And then like, as soon as I crossed the Florida line, start the clock. And I was, man, we have to be out in 48 hours. And we're like hauling ass to get out of the state in time. And I think I was in the state for about 51 or 2 hours. And I made it.
Probably ran a greater risk by speeding, drawing attention to yourself than if you'd have just acted like a normal human being and taken your time.
You are 100% correct.
But I was saying that just because you have a fear, when I pass police holding guns, I have a fear that those guns could be turned on me. That doesn't mean that's a realistic fear, but in view of the recent police shootings, maybe it is a realistic fear. But just because you have a fear, that doesn't make it legitimate.
I completely, completely, completely agree with you. But there is certainly a higher degree chance of getting shot with a gun present than not.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that fear is probably more realistic than the fear of I'm going to be in a state 73 hours and they're going to prosecute me. I have not unearthed a case like that yet. And I always issue the challenge, please show me the case. There's several challenges I've issued. I've issued the one where a person says, well, I get violated. I've got revoked for simply failing a polygraph. I said, well, show me the petition to revoke where all it says is you failed a polygraph. That's all it says. And there no petition has ever been unearthed. Now, it says they failed the polygraph, they show deception, and they made several incriminating admissions after that in the post-polygraph interview. That's what's actually in the petition. Or they've shown me petitions that said that they failed one or two polygraphs, and then their treatment was terminated. And then the petition revoke says condition of probation was successfully participating in complete treatment. Person terminated from treatment, and the basis for the termination was failure of the polygraph. That's not the same thing as saying, I mean, it indirectly is, but that's not the same petition as saying they just simply showed deception on a polygraph. It's splitting it's splitting hairs, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah, and just before we get too far removed from it, Mike in chat says, I'll lend my Geiger counter if needed, as if, you know, if you're in the state for too long so that you can see if you're emitting radiation.
We appreciate that Geiger counter. I would like to use it next time I'm traveling to see how well it picks up. Because next time we have a conference, we can try that.
Yes, especially if there's a whole bunch of us in one consolidated place, you'd think that the Geiger counter would go off more.
Well, that's the whole thing. But like people, when there's a conference, well, if I'm here 73 hours, okay. When's the last time you've seen law enforcement circulating through a hotel conference checking ID? Well, of course, as old as I am, I've never seen it. And I've never found anybody who's seen that happen. But they have the fear that the cops are going to go through circulating through the hotel and say, I think there might be some sexual offenders in here that are beyond the 72 hours. Yep, there's one over there. I mean,
show me your plane ticket. When did you arrive? And they're going to go interview the 200 people at the conference to see when each and every one of them arrived.
So, but now it is remotely possible. If you were to have an event at the hotel that required sequestration of the property, if there were to be a mass shooting or something, I have a feeling the mass shooting would probably take priority over sex offenders. But if you had some event, if you had Legionnaire's disease or something, and they had to quarantine, it's possible that they could discover a person. But it's so remote that you'd spend your energy would be better spent doing other things. But if you want to live a life of being that concerned about imaginary boogeymen, you remind me of the sheriffs who are promoting imaginary boogeymen on Halloween. I mean, you can convince yourself that there's a boogeyman out to get you. Now, they are out to get you. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. There are people sitting out in registration offices that are out to get you, but they're going to get you on something just a tad bit more than that. They're going to get you on being late on your 90 days. They're going to get you on failure to report an automobile that you've been driving for 2 weeks and you're supposed to report it within 72 hours. They're going to get you on those little trivialities. They're not going to get you that you were in the state of Georgia for 73 hours. Mm-hmm. But they are out to get you.
And, you know, you could end up in some sort of very benign thing, like you have a teeny little fender bender that the police get called into.
I'm familiar with that. I've heard of people who have done it.
All right, let's move into the meat and potatoes of this show, Larry.
Alrighty.
I like poking fun at you for that one, by the way. This first one comes from mainpublic.org, and it's 22 months in solitary violated Maine inmate's rights, but he's not entitled to damages. Judge rules. How do you spend 22 months in solitary confinement? And they said it's like it's five days a week of 24 hours a day, and then only a handful of hours on those other 2 days to give you some rec time. That's insanity. And
I thought it was in reverse. He had 5 days a week where he was out an hour a day, and then 2 days where he was not.
Let's split hairs over that one. And when he's on the quote unquote yard, when he's in the cage that has open air, he's cuffed. Not like you can move around. Like, this is insanity. And so then they said, well, the all we needed from the prison was that they had justification to keep you locked up in there. So sorry, you're screwed.
I wasn't able to see an opinion attached to this. I just was able to read the article, so it's difficult to really give a lot of pontification one way or the other. But I can say that sometimes judges' hands are tied because he's not entitled to damages because the law doesn't provide any. Now, you don't want, being a good constitutional textualist, you don't want judges legislating from the bench and creating something that just isn't provided for in law. Now, would you?
No, absolutely not.
I think the bulk of our conservative audience would not want that. And so it could very well be that the judge didn't have the ability to grant him relief. It could have been that he used the wrong vehicle to try to get relief, meaning that the wrong cause of action. It may be in a habeas corpus. I don't know what he filed. Like I said, I don't have anything here to work with. But it could be that that particular vehicle doesn't provide the type of relief he was looking to in terms of damages. So we don't know that the court did anything wrong based on the information we have here. But what we do know is that 22 months in solitary confinement is something that the state of Maine ought to take very seriously. And they ought to look at how much latitude they're providing their prison administrators. And they ought to do what we did. And we've limited the corrections department on how they can utilize solitary confinement because we determined that they could not self-discipline and do, it's kind of like forcing women to give birth with their hands and shackles and everything. They couldn't do the right thing themselves. So we had to legislate and limit what they can do in solitary confinement. And I can't tell you word for word what we did, but the corrections department here has been limited, and that may be what needs to be done in Maine as well.
I'm pretty sure, let's see, the Human Rights Watch, I guess is what it is, they said that anything more than 15 days is considered a human rights violation. And correct me if I'm wrong, my math isn't so strong. 22 months is longer than 15 days?
Well, but that's an international globalist thing. America, we don't need to be paying no attention. I mean, foreign law has nothing to do with us, and we are the beacon of human rights. And if we do it in America, it passes every standard. There's no one should even question anything America does. And you're unpatriotic to even suggest that we should be bound by anything that someone in the rest of the world says. Who are they to tell the United States of America what to do and what constitutes a human rights violation? Well, we're the savior and the protector of human rights all over the world. That's just totally offensive to me.
And then you really make me want to bring up children in cages, but we shouldn't go there. All right. Well, let's move over. Go ahead. Finish.
That would be the reaction to a lot of people out there in terms of now. The only time we want to rely on international law is when it suits our purposes. And all of a sudden, people who say that thumb their nose at international law, they say, "Oh, well, that's a violation of international law." And I said, "Well, wait a minute. Does international law come into play, or is it American law? Which is it? Because you like to thumb your nose at international law most of the time, and then you'll cite to international law when it suits something that you'd like to see in. Is international law relevant, or is it just situational? It's like situational ethics. You're either an ethical person or you're not an ethical person. Situational ethics that's no good.
I think the answer to this is the UN only has, I guess if there's like a larger council, but they would collectively sanction a country that is not playing by the rules, but they don't have any like law enforcement apparatus, as you like to call it. They don't have any way they're not going to come invade the United States and lock up people for some sort of violation in the country. They're just going to say, you guys can't play in this playground anymore.
Well, they just issue reports and condemnations and pointed out that I mean, like there's travel alerts for countries visiting America about civil rights, questionable civil rights practices here, human rights practices. We're not too fond of honoring all of our international treaty obligations in terms of giving them access to their foreign government. But of course, we get very upset if Americans held them. We can't have access. You know, it's a different story.
Of course.
Well, you know, it goes both ways, though.
Mm-hmm. I do. I was just having a conversation with someone in chat about hypocrisy, about doing something along the same lines, just on a smaller scale.
As Georgia governor, former Georgia governor Lester Maddox said, hypocrisy.
Oh, sorry. I need to figure out how to pronounce that word better. Let's move over to an article from Wired.com, The Delicate Ethics of Using Facial Recognition in Schools. A growing number of school districts are deploying cameras and software to prevent attacks, but the systems are also used to monitor students and adult critics. Very, very loosely, tangentially related to the registry that the article features someone that kind of got in trouble and wants to go to maybe his sister's graduation. And like within seconds of this kid sitting down, the sheriff's deputies come and asked him his name and escorted him out because they got high resolution cameras looking at the people visiting into the school and escorting you out if you fit onto the no-no list. I keep saying this, as much as in favor of computers and artificial intelligence, I think it's coming down the pike and I think it's a wonderful thing. There are certainly places that it's going to get misused and we need to seriously sequester how these things are used. And I don't think that this is the right way to use it.
Well, let's just be clear so that we don't mislead people. This was on a steamy May evening where 9,000 people had filed into Stingray, I don't know how to pronounce it, stadium in Texas City, which they have huge stadiums for high school football. It's just an enormous thing in Texas. They almost fund some of their high schools better than college teams. But this was the thousands of people at this event, and they were running facial recognition on everybody who entered the stadium.
I just see this as being rife for opportunities to be misused or misidentify people because, you know, can only be X accurate. And, you know, let's just hypothetically say that that person was misidentified and now he got perhaps embarrassed by having the police come up and ask him questions. Man, I just hate this stuff. I really do. I don't think this is the right way to go.
Well, the school administration defends it because they say that the district says it doesn't intend to watch students. Rather, officials say they want to keep out unwelcome visitors, including suspended students and local sex offenders.
Well, riddle me this. How are they not watching students if they're watching everyone to see if someone fits the profile?
Well, but I mean, we're not going to misuse the information, Andy. You don't understand. We have the best of intentions, and our intentions are pure. We're trying to keep the children who've been entrusted to our care safe as they can possibly be. And all we want to do is to use this not to spy on them, but to protect them. I don't know why you liberal do-gooders are always out there trying to undermine law enforcement, and then you gripe about what a dangerous society you live in, and then you try to tie our hands so we can't do our jobs. All we're trying to do is increase the element of safety. What is it with you people that you're always trying to tie our hands and undo good things?
Privacy, man. Fourth Amendment.
We're not going to put this out for the world to see. You see how we used it responsibly. We took a suspended student who had been a disciplinary problem out of the event, and we kept the event booze and calm for everybody. That's a good thing, right?
Of course, until someone misuses it.
Who would do that?
Who would do it, you say?
People who work in law enforcement and work in school districts are of the purest intentions. You wouldn't even be working with the kids if you didn't have the most honorable intentions. I mean, everybody knows that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I got visited by the Popo today to update my registry information, and he was super friendly and courteous. And, you know, he was here for, I don't know, 2 minutes and was on his way. So, yes. What is it? Let's say 95% of them. But, man, there are some seriously bad apples, and those bad apples are like making people die. Not a fan.
Well, I can tell you what's going to happen now on a more serious note if everybody discounts and disregards everything I said up to now. What this is happening here is this giant new industry is proliferating across the country because of the advancements and the relatively low cost of technology. These are tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars these districts are spending on this. But this is a huge business. And once this apparatus is in place, at all the schools, you will never dismantle it. You will never get rid of it. The time to say something is to speak up now. But once it's in, it's not leaving. And this is going to be like the rest of the industrial complexes that spring up. You're gonna have this stuck with you in for eternity.
I do understand. Larry, and now we're going to move over to an article from the Shelby Star. Cleveland County Law Enforcement Embraces Online Interaction. This is an article that talks about the law enforcement apparatus. I really like that term that you use for this, that they will ask their people on Facebook or on, I guess, probably pretty much just on Facebook and say, hey, this thing happened at this time and this address. If you have any input feedback, and they're just asking the community to help them police, and people are sending in pictures or they recognize a person in a picture. And they're able to apprehend people significantly faster, which I can see some challenges of people misusing it. But like, why would that be a bad thing?
Well, in addition to what you described, they use if you went to a major city police department these days, they have a significant internet operation. I mean, they're monitoring people's social media as well, because something about criminals, they just have a habit that they have to communicate with one another. And As means of communication have evolved, people have gravitated using social media. So a lot of crimes are solved because of the criminals themselves and the trail they leave on social media. So those of you out there committing crimes, just remember the police are watching you on social media as well.
It seems like it would be a bad idea to not use some kind of encrypted communication if you're going to be a criminal mindset.
But again, you have to remember that sometimes people commit crimes or not all that savvy. That's how they get caught.
Yeah, it's funny. There was an article I read in Wired magazine, and you know, we just covered an article from them, but this was like from 2010 or something like that. And some math whiz had figured out how to game lottery scratch-off cards. Like, there was a certain pattern that you could predict which ones would win. But he, even knowing which ones would win and how fast he would have to buy them, he could only earn like $60,000 a year. And he goes, I make more than that as a math researcher, scientist or other. So it was like, I mean, I appreciate that I got to figure it out, but it's not worth my time.
So he could beat the system, but he couldn't beat it enough to make it worth the while.
Yeah. I mean, like, who wants to sit there and do scratch offs all day? That would be tedious. That would be one of the most tedious jobs you could ever imagine. Right. Just sitting there with a coin, scratching off the little gold dust, whatever.
Well, what did you say it paid, though?
It was like $60,000 is what I remember the article saying. But he, in his mathematical genius job that he was in, he made more than that. And I just use that as a reference to go, people that are, that you know, they're more educated, they have higher paying jobs, whatever. They don't need to commit criminal acts, typically, because it's not most crimes are economically incentives.
That's something that's still open to debate by the people who share that belief, and I do share that there's a lot of economics, but there are people who believe that in this good old country we live in, there's not any reason in the world for a person to commit anything criminal, because the opportunities are out there, and you can just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and there's no reason for that. So that's not a universal acceptance of economics drive criminality. The data show that it does, but people, despite the data, don't agree.
Well, it certainly isn't the only thing, but I bet let's just throw a number out. 75% of crimes are somebody is in poverty and they need to get something accomplished. So they figure that that's a path of least resistance, including the risk.
Well, now you're going to cause me to go off a detour here because you're talking about economics. I mean, like economic statistics and mathematics, and I'm not a mathematical wizard, and I profess that, but I do know how to do basic addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. And I was listening to a talk show today, and they were talking about the mathematical mean and the harmonic mean, and I believe that was the term. Can you explain what the harmonic mean is if you buy, they were talking about dollar cost averaging. So if you buy 100 shares of stock for $10, and the price falls by 50%, and you buy 100 shares for $5, your average cost is what? What everybody immediately says, $7.50. But that's not your average cost per share. If you add up the $1,000 and the $500, which comes to $1,500, and you divide that by 200 shares, you have an average cost of $666.67 per share. And he said the reason why the difference is because the mathematical, the arithmetic mean versus the harmonic mean. So what is the harmonic mean?
Man, I'd never heard of it until you just said it. And I look it up and I see that Pythagorean is in there. So that's like the thing with the triangles, the Pythagorean theorem. Got me, man. I would have to like poke down and study that one for a minute. Got me. No idea.
Okay. So I will, but like at first blush, if you ask somebody what their average cost per share would be, they would say $7.50 because if you paid 10 for 100, you paid 5 for another 100, mm-hmm. Well, the mean would be 750, but that's not the average cost. If you take $1,500 and divide it by 200, correct, that's not what each share cost you.
I agree with that.
So, okay, well, let's get back to the show.
Yes, but yeah, sorry for the math detour.
I had to figure out, I learned something new today, but I still don't understand it.
Can you see a negative angle on Leo using social media to try and get tips and stuff like that?
Well, at first blush, no. As anything, that I'm sure that as time progresses and they enhance and they push the limits of what law enforcement typically does is what human nature typically does, as we push the limits and the boundaries. I'm sure as time goes along, we'll find that something that they do is over the top. That no, they shouldn't be doing that. But right now, since I'm not a big user of social media, I don't know where those limits are and where they should be and what law enforcement will do that will test those limits, but you can be assured they will test the limits.
Part of the idea behind Facebook is, you know, they're all about building communities, and your community could be that you have a certain kind of legal expertise, Larry, and you could have meetings with similar minds across the globe. It doesn't have to be communities in your neighborhood, so to speak. And so this provides a way, at least in theory, that the people of your city, you know, some sort of geographic, you know, where you're in proximity to them, that you guys have some kind of community and you're pulling each other along and encouraging and so forth. That's one of the founding principles behind Facebook, besides them trolling all of your information and selling it to for nefarious purposes.
No, not Facebook.
It's going to be fun to watch that develop over all these periods of time and of how much stuff they are collecting about you. Even if you have no Facebook account, even if you block everything, they are still gathering troves and troves of information about what your interaction with the world is. It's very, very, very strange. It's a very disturbing amount of information that they're gathering.
So Facebook is collecting on all those millions who are not connected to them?
Correct. I don't have a Facebook account, and so many websites, even the company that I work for, we have Facebook trackers to gather analytics. And, you know, even if they don't know who you are, they know who you are. Like on the outside, they don't have necessarily a name and a face to an anonymous code of some kind. They still have a pretty good idea who Larry is. Let's move over to an article from, man, this totally looks like Oreo Online, but it's Oregon Live. Oregon judge ordered woman to type in her iPhone passcode so police could search it for evidence against her. This is a breach of the Fifth Amendment, Larry. You should never have to reveal your password. But I guess they could say you have to reveal the combination to your safe, and if you don't, then they hold you in contempt and you get put in jail for that. This woman crashed a car and they want to get into her phone, and I'm not sure why they want to get into her phone, what evidence they're trying to get off the phone. But anyway, so a judge says she has to unlock the phone, and I think they put her in jail for some period of time because she wasn't cooperating.
That is correct, and not only a judge said it, the Oregon Court of Appeals said that she has to. And people at first blush, they say, no, but it's not as simple as you would think it is. You have the right not to testify against yourself, but is unlocking the phone testimonial? It would be like, say, I knew a person who used to make obscene and prank phone calls. And if a judge orders you to speak a particular set of words that were recorded on the receiving, if anybody has a old-fashioned answer machine anymore, but whatever device people leave messages on, if a judge says speak these words, that's not testimonial. Or if the judge says you're ordered to have your genitals photographed because the complaining witness said that there was a particular scar or whatever, that's not testimonial. If you're ordered to give your fingerprints, that's not testimonial. If you're ordered to give your DNA. So this is just not as clear cut as one would think at first blush, because she wasn't being ordered to testify. She was being ordered on a phone that had been taken into custody, for which a warrant had been issued through establishing a probable cause. She was ordered to assist in the search of the device that had been ordered by a court to be searched. And that's what makes this so unique. And there's a little case law. In fact, in Oregon, they could not even cite to any Oregon case on point. So they considered this to be a matter of first impression, because there was no case law. So they had to look at case law from other jurisdictions and from the Supreme Court. So I went through and did my typical markups on here. So those who are interested in the case of Oregon versus Pittman. It is for the legal gurus. It's a fun read to figure out, to go through how they discern what's testimonial, what isn't. And then there was a doctrine I've never heard of, and I'm trying to thumb through the decision to see that. I said, gee, I've never even heard of that doctrine. The foregone conclusion doctrine, as discussed later, is a term of art. The Fifth Amendment jurisprudence defendant opposed the state's motion, arguing that the warrant was overbroad and compelling her to disclose iPhone would violate the Constitution. But I wasn't familiar with the foregone conclusion, so I don't have enough to opine about that. But there's some good reading in here for those who like to read court decisions.
I might have to read that one. I'm very interested in this Fifth Amendment thing. And I know that something that you are, which would be a biometric signal, so that would be a fingerprint, an iris scan, something like, or face lock that people use a lot. those are not going to be protected by Fifth Amendment, but something stuck inside your little brain, your little gray matter up there that somehow is protected. I just get troubled with this kind of stuff, Larry, that the amount of information that not somebody that has a $30 phone, but somebody that, you know, they store all of their family photos. They have their banking information. They have all of their contacts. They have all of their email. They have all of this data on their phone. And that shouldn't be, I think that should to some degree be outside of the realm of, you know, like a search warrant. If they're looking for, hey, we're looking for drug paraphernalia, and they find a whole arsenal of weapons. Well, that wasn't on the search warrant. You have to disregard the weapon. Maybe not the weapons. Maybe that's not a great example. But they're tailored to look for a specific thing. Do you think that we could get law enforcement, do we get legislation to say that a search warrant only allows you to look for these kinds of things on your phone, and you have to ignore, exclude whatever else you may find, not just an open door?
Well, the search warrant would have been focused on what it is that what they were looking for. It wouldn't have said just to go on a fishing expedition for the. They would have said that there was an accident resulting in injury or death. I forget which it was, but they were looking. They would have been looking for something relevant to that. They wouldn't have just had a fishing warrant. It wouldn't have said just go fishing for whatever you can find. But I think she was involved in you know, there was allegations of drug use.
Yes.
And that she might have been under the influence, and they were looking for evidence to support that. And she wasn't being asked to testify against herself. They were just looking like they would do in a routine search. It's just that we have evolved now to where there are other places to search other than the person's home or their person. I guess the phone would be considered an effect. So the warrant was issued to search the phone. She would not cooperate with the search. How is that different than if the warrant's issued to search your house and you open fire and try to prevent the search?
Correct.
I mean, that's essentially what she was doing by refusing to type in the password.
I do agree, you know, with a lawful search warrant that you and if you don't, then you get held in contempt. Go back to the safe conversation, because I don't think that's necessarily a fair analog. The safe is at least better, but they would eventually be able to bust into the safe physically, get a locksmith to reset the code so they can get in. They would have a much easier time getting in there. When you fire up all of the encryption and all that, I'm inclined to short of the NSA and those kinds of organizations, your local law enforcement people are not going to have access to your device.
But again, she was obstructing.
Yeah.
And on page 6 of the opinion, it says the fact that subpoena documents themselves may contain incriminating information is irrelevant to the Fifth Amendment because they were created voluntarily, not under compulsion.
Right.
She was creating all the evidence that was in this phone voluntarily, not under compulsion.
Correct. I get it.
This yeah. So, but the foregone conclusion is something I have to do some more study on, because on page 8 it says, if the existence, location, and authenticity of documents is a foregone conclusion, then compelling a person to assemble those documents for production does not reveal the person's mental processes and therefore is not sufficiently testimonial to trigger the Fifth Amendment. However, if the government has minimal information about what documents exist, or what they contain, the act of locating and selecting the documents to produce may require the subpoena recipient to use her own mental processes in a way that renders the resulting response testimonial. So what that's saying is that they weren't asking her to give any testimony. They were going to draw their own conclusions. They weren't engaging in a question session with her. They just said, type in the whatever the code it is so that we can see in this phone. And so the court found that was not testimonial. And it was a valid search warrant, and she was not cooperating, so she lost.
Yes. There's a poll on the screen in the article that says, should police be able to force you to punch in your phone passcode? And yes, for law and order, 12%. No, privacy wins, 87.9% of the people in Oregon. My question to you, Larry, is, to me, Oregon feels to be a little bit of a different kind of state. Just their culture there seems to be more about some privacy and liberty kind of things. How do you think that would play out in the general population? Do you think it would rate the same?
I think it would probably be very similar, maybe not 87%. But I think, as we saw in the Supreme Court when they ruled about the phone needing a search warrant, I think that people are going to somehow equate the phone to a heightened level of privacy expectation, and they're going to be very protective of their phone because of what's on it. So if the 87% is really accurate, if that's a reliable poll, then the people in Oregon need to express that through their legislative process, yeah, and tell the law enforcement apparatus that you want this to happen, and you can pass a law. As Scalia says, if you want to enlarge the rights you have, you don't need the people in the robes to give you these protections. You can do it through the process. If 87% of you want additional protections for the phone, express that through the elective process, and you'll get that.
So, I mean, that's not like some sort of 55%, which is a pretty good majority, but not 90%, 88% as this is. That is an incredibly strong majority. I would like to hear what the law and order people, the 12%, I would like to hear what their arguments are to say that, do you just want everyone to run around with their phone unlocked all the time? That includes corporate secrets. That includes, I can't imagine why you would just think that, yes, you should just open up your phone to everybody.
Well, I don't think that was the question here. The question was whether you'd open your phone up after it had been ordered by the court, as it was subject to a search issued. A warrant that was issued through a directive of the court that search take place. Again, if a judge issues an order that your dwelling be searched, you cannot stand in the way of that. You'll be hauled off to jail.
Yeah. And you know, the Waco, Texas doing. Thing would ensue. They would eventually bring in the larger and larger hardware to gain access to your dwelling at some point.
Yes, the search, the process would be, of course, I can understand if I thought I was protecting myself, I can understand her reasoning, but the process would be is you cooperate with search, and then you take that up on appeal, and you move to suppress the product of the search, and she could have made these same arguments without ever sitting in jail, but she didn't choose that route, but right. Anyway, that she's lost, and if the people of Oregon feel that strongly, they need to change the law. You don't want the judges who were not elected in most instances making the law, do you? That's an evolving, you don't want that evolving standards of decency. You don't want people who are not accountable deciding in some kind of secret club what the law should be and how to evolve the law. You don't want that. There's a process for making law, isn't there?
I believe that there is. I believe. Time is running out for you to submit your congratulatory message for us reaching episode 100. There, like I said, there's a handful of slots left. I would love to have a whole bunch pour in so that I can fill up the show with all these congratulatory messages. You can record a voice memo on your phone, and then you can email that to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or if you want to do it old school, you could phone in to 747-227-4477 and record a voicemail message. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it, and I'll talk to you soon. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. We should move on then to this next article, which is a sort of like happy, happy, feel good one. It's OPB.org, which I don't know what OPB stands for, but Tara Simmons looks to become the first former inmate elected to Washington legislature. I'm pretty sure that wouldn't happen in Georgia, or, you know, we could come up with another state. I think Kentucky is one where one of our people is trying to become a lawyer, and he has been prevented thus far, as far as I know. This is kind of neat news, Larry. For someone that's formerly incarcerated, a convicted felon, she got promoted up to the bar. She passed the bar exam, and now she's running for a legislative position, as I believe.
And she has the backing of the current holder of the seat, who's retiring.
That's kind of neat. Also,
the seat is currently held by Representative Sherry Appleton, an 8-term Democrat who recently announced she will retire. I can tell you it wouldn't happen here because you're never allowed to hold public office after you have that conviction. So we don't have that option here.
P Period. End of story. So you're a felon. You can never hold elected office.
That is correct. Now, you could hold a federal office, but, okay. but you couldn't hold a state office here.
Can you share with me your opinion in both directions of why you would or wouldn't allow someone?
It's hard for me to get into the minds of people who believe that you should never allow a person to hold. I think there should be a rehabilitation process for anyone who's out in the community. We're assuming that if they get turned out into community, they've paid their debt. We can also assume that if they've been turned out into community and they have a track record of being successful, that they probably have changed unless they've been so slick that they've evaded criminality, detection of their criminality. So we can assume that they're a full participating citizen. I can't think of any justifiable reason. I think it goes back to the paranoia that they have about letting felons vote because they're going to tip the scales. I think that it's an unjustified fear of something bad that would happen would be that these people are going to be pro-felon and they're going to be for chaos. I don't understand. You'd have to ask a person who has the fear. I don't have that fear. And I don't think there's any rational justification for it. It's just like the Second Amendment. Your right to why is Martha Stewart not allowed to protect herself?
Because she could be a dangerous, like Rambo wielding M60 carrying MF running around mowing up the town. I mean, that's how Martha, when you see her eyes when she's making those cooking pots and pans, she looks kind of devious.
So my question is we have the Second Amendment. So if you've ever made a mistake in your life and so many things rise to a level of felony, if we truly believe that weapons provide a level of safety and protection, why is it that we disenfranchise 20-25% of the population if they are not allowed to protect and defend their families?
There was one of the people at the hearing on Thursday. He's off all of the supervision. He's like, and you're putting the sign in my yard and I have no ability to defend me or my family or my property.
Yes, that's the point I'm making. So I don't understand this mindset that I think rehabilitation is evident after a period of time. And I think that people ought to be fully participating, serving on juries, serving in public office. And I just don't understand this. They have to be punished for the rest of their life.
If I can throw something out there and I'm going to get all kinds of hate mail. So let's just hypothetically say that the representative, I think it's in Minnesota, the one that wears the hijab. Let's just say hypothetically that she tried to get it. She got into office and let's say she was pushing for some super radical, like Muslim terrorist kinds of laws. They would never make it very far. So how it, like if you then elected a very, very large minority of people that had felony convictions and they tried to say, hey, we want chaos and we want to just watch the city burn. The rest of the legislature wouldn't vote for it. It wouldn't get passed. So what's the risk?
You do have some people who are on the extreme side of the political spectrum on both sides of the spectrum who get in office. They're usually outliers and they seldom succeed in passing anything because their agenda is so far outside. You have to have our system is set up to where it requires a lot to pass legislation. And unless it's distorted by massive public opinion, the process is filled with checks and balances. That's the way it was intended. It's supposed to be hard to pass laws. It that was designed that way.
Yeah, right. There's supposed to be all the controversy. There's the debate, all the opportunities for the public to push back, which most of us don't take any sort of interest in. Interesting. Anyway, so here, this woman, hopefully, so she is going, she's at least on the ticket and well-supported and all that. And hopefully she'll win and that maybe she'll be a shining star in the Washington and be an example for other people to push back.
I'm imagining that OPB is probably Oregon Public Broadcasting, I'm guessing.
You're a smart dude.
But but that left coast, there's a bunch of wacko nut jobs out there.
Clearly.
I mean, they're the ones driving the country over the cliff. They got minimum wage going through the stratosphere and people can't find housing. Even they've jacked the wages up to $15 an hour and they have homelessness galore in these places.
Assisted suicide.
It's just a cesspool, that whole part of the country. And for folks, I'm being very facetious because that's what the right wingers say. They say that, you can't win because like these places are having enormous prosperity despite the fact that wages are higher than the rest of the country, and which is supposed to destroy the economy. And then the fact that they have booming economies, lots of jobs, and shortage of labor, and shortage of housing because the value of the housing stock has gone up through the roof. Seattle, you can't afford to get a broom closet up there these days. But they say that all this stuff is bad. But I thought prosperity was good. You know, you just can't win. You know, you have prosperity and a booming economy and creating the California's been leading the nation in job creation for a number of years now. But you know, you can't win.
I understand, Larry. Let's move over to Fox 8 in Cleveland. Sex offender safety tips ahead of trick or treat. I only want to cover this article because of the 10-ish or so bullet points that they make. I think maybe one or two of them are specifically apply to trick-or-treating. The rest of them would just be, these are probably at least decent ideas to get your kid to know how to dial 911, teach them to say no. Anyway, I just think that this is a whole bunch of hyperbole and exaggeration of an imaginary boogeyman. And anyway, that's really all I wanted to do.
Yeah, well, it's the safety tips are generally good rules for the most part, except for the imaginary ones, you know, for the threats that don't exist. But it's like I was listening to a talk show today while I was on the treadmill, and they were talking about, according to a journal of the American Medical Association, the death rate for children, the accident rate, I think the injury rate goes up tenfold on Halloween. Guess why? Not because of sex offenders, vehicles. But because of what?
Vehicles. Yes. Getting tagged by a car running down the road, you know, 10 or 20 miles over the speed limit while someone's coming back from a Halloween party or on their way to, and they've already started drinking.
So, Sheriff Long, if you actually wanted to keep your citizens in Butts County safe, you'd be out there on them streets keeping them trick-or-treaters safe. That's what you'd be doing. But you're pontificating for higher office. That's what you're doing.
While I was sitting there listening, I was like, you know, with the number of people, you know, on November 1st, you're going to see articles about three kids mowed down here, a couple mowed down there in these different cities. Why don't all the cops just post their cars on corners of trafficked areas, turn on the lights, and you just stand out there and shake hands, kiss babies, do all the politicking that you want, just to get people to stay aware and slow the F down on this night. Don't bother with our people, because this is just ridiculous. Slow the cars down, and then you won't have any sort of incidents overnight.
But if we did that, you understand. If the sex offenders knowed we weren't watching on them, if they know that.
Did you say knowed?
What they knowed, yes. If they.
Love it. Love it. Love it.
If they know there wasn't anybody watching them, they would have a field day. It'd be a paradise for them. We have to be. The reason why nothing happens is because we're out there monitoring. I don't know why you liberals can't understand that.
Can we move over to this recent article that sort of goes along the same lines? It's a Florida cops went to absurd lengths to entrap man who showed no interest in underage sex. Reading this article, they tried and tried and tried and tried. And this guy turns out to be a county employee. Maybe he even worked for the sheriff's office. I know he was a county employee. And he found someone on Tinder who was 18 years old. And he's like, hey, I'm bored at work and I just want to chat. Turns out to be law enforcement. And so he's chatting with the 18-year-old. And I'm doing air quotes here like anybody can see me. And then it's like, oh, hey, by the way, I'm 14. And he's like, cool. Maybe we shouldn't talk so much. And they kept pushing, and then they started sending sexy images. And he's just like, hey, you know, keep it cool. Take your time. No rush or anything. And like, they forced him into, this would be the definition of entrapment, wouldn't it, Larry?
Well, he wasn't arrested, but the part that I found appalling was that they did the bait and switch, and he didn't bite for that. Then they started talking about sex, saying that the pretended 14 were saying that she wanted to experience sex, and he was actually doing the right thing, saying no, you don't need to rush that, you have plenty of time, and they just couldn't leave it alone. The thing is, you need Sarasota. We talked about this before. This is just an extension of a previous, you know, what we talked about a couple of episodes back. And this article, I think, it's by Lenore, right?
Is this by Lenore? I didn't catch if it was. Yes, it is. Totally is.
This is her pontificating from, it used to be Free Range Kids. I don't know what her website is.
It is now called Let Grow.
let grow. Okay. Well, this is Lenore saying the same kind of stuff that I say, is that, except I say it a little more boldly. The only way you're going to stop it is you're going to have to curtail the law enforcement's resources. The reason why they can do this is because you give them the personnel. I started to say manpower. That's not politically correct, but you give them the personnel. And if you take the personnel away, they'll stop doing it.
Seems pretty simple. I'm pretty sure that's going to be a lot more complicated than just that to get there.
Oh, it's going to be a lot more complicated because they come in and require the sky's falling, even though crime is down by 50%, which we'll see in one of our articles that we're going to soon cover. They convince you that they need more and more resources, and the public just blindly falls into line and says, yes, we do. I support the police. Whatever the police say they need, the police get.
We should, and then they turn around and they use that to then justify their existence for the next year, and then they gotta get the budget increase next year, even though they probably should have had a budget decrease from year over year, if this is what they're using their resources to do.
That is correct, but it'll never happen.
Good read, Lenore. Thank you. Did you watch the video of this next one from the Washington Post?
I did not.
They blurred it for redaction purposes, and this is a Phoenix Fires officer who pulled a gun on parents after their 4-year-old took a doll from the dollar store. Watching the video,
what's the problem with that?
I knew that was coming. I totally knew that was coming. Yeah. What the problem with that? I don't see a problem with it. I guess the girl took a baby doll from the Family Dollar store, and when they went and interrogated the family over it, they ended up like being kind of violent with the family as they were doing their pat down and stuff. They pinned the father up against the car, and you know, they tell him to spread his legs. And you know, you can never spread your legs far enough, right, Larry? I don't know if you've ever been involved in this, if you've had this happen to any.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So then they kick the inside of his leg so hard that he actually like buckles. And then of course, now you're not standing up. So now you're a threat. So now they have to like jack you up in the air. And meanwhile, the kids are screaming and all this is, Over stealing a doll from the local dollar store.
I don't know why you liberals don't understand this. All he needed to do is comply with the police. Whatever they tell you, regardless of how many times you've been through this before, you need to just do whatever they tell you. End of discussion.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, no doubt. The officer tried to rip Harper's youngest child from her arms, the claim stated. Eventually, he threw Harper, who had handed the children to a bystander, into the police car face first and then handcuffed her. Then the cop says, I could have shot you in front of your effing kids. This is over a $2 stuffed animal from the dollar store? All right.
It's for noncompliance with police commands. You're supposed to do what the police tell you. I don't know why you don't understand that.
I'm pretty sure that's actually like, that's false, isn't it? You don't have to. It's not, you don't like, maybe you should, maybe it's wise too, but I don't know that you have to comply with all of their orders. Do you?
Well, we have a crime called failure to obey an officer. We have one. So yes, you're supposed to do whatever they tell you.
At all times, any situation, day, night.
You do what the police tell you.
He says, do the hokey pokey dance and you have to do the hokey pokey dance.
That's right, and you won't have any problem. You guys bring this on yourself by being disobedient. It shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter if you've been pulled over 50 times and asked why you're in a particular neighborhood, why you're doing this, can you open the trunk? It shouldn't matter. You do it the 51st, the 52nd, the 53rd, and you always cooperate with the police, and you won't have these issues.
Interesting. I
didn't watch it.
What?
I didn't watch the video, so I don't know what the video shows.
To be completely transparent, in watching it, I didn't see some of the things that they're describing in the article. I did see where they kicked the guy's leg, and sometimes cops get overzealous or they're juiced up on some adrenaline because the situation is so intense or whatever. It didn't look like that kind of situation. It looked very kind of low key. And he's like, hey, what are you arresting me for? And they're like, you're not compliant. Get on the ground, whatever. And so it seems like they escalated. To me, it seemed like it.
Well, even if you haven't done anything wrong, even if you're 70 years old, you should get on the ground.
Maybe it's hard. Oh, and that was another thing in the story. They were telling the mom to put the kid on the ground or something like that. And like the ground is hot. It's Phoenix, Arizona. This is, this is several months ago that this actually occurred. This was June 12th. Can you imagine how hot the pavement was on June 12th in Phoenix, Arizona?
Well, it's disobedience. You should just do what the officer tells you.
I don't like you, Larry. All right, we're going to move on.
I don't. Well, it's that simple. People bring these problems on themselves by being disobedient. We've had people on this podcast. If you just simply tell the officer what you're doing, even if it's been 35 times, you should just simply cooperate.
I think there's truth in there. I just don't know that it's always true.
So, well, I don't know the whole story here. Yeah. So I don't know what went on, and I'm being a bit facetious about it. But that is the attitude of people who've never experienced any overzealous conduct by the police. That is their attitude. They can't imagine what they have not experienced. They cannot imagine having to repeatedly open their vehicles because it hasn't happened to them, and they're not aware of that part of society, that segment of society that experiences this, and the frustration you would eventually, it would build up, when you're asked to do things that other people are not asked to do simply because of the way you look, how that builds inside you. You get tired of it. But if you've never had it happen to you, you can't relate to it. I can't relate to it. I never have to account for where I'm at or why I'm there.
Of course. It's because you go to bed at like 9 o'clock at night. No one else sees you out, after dark practically.
Now, if I were out in a drug infested zone, as a person brought up, it is possible that I could be pulled over and asked, gee, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and this is a known drug activity. And of course, my reaction would be, I'm driving through. Do I need to have a reason to drive through?
Doesn't seem like you would need to, right?
Really? Is that a law enforcement matter? Do you really need to? Say I have to give you an itinerary of where I'm going and why I'm here. But that only works for a middle-aged white guy. 21-year-old black guy with dreads and telling a cop that and see what happens, particularly if you tell a white cop that.
Yeah, no doubt. This is another one that you pulled the case for from the Denver Post. It's hundreds of prisoners can seek new trials, freedom after Colorado Supreme Court rules sentences illegal. And I wrote in the notes for this, like, I read through the article and I'm like, I don't quite understand. So please feel free to dumb it down for all of us.
Well, it's an important decision from the Colorado Supreme Court in the case of Allman versus the people. And, simple as I can make it, it's a short, relatively short opinion, 12 pages. The person decided he was befriended by an elder man, and he, in exchange for the for being befriended, he decided to steal the guy's money and his identity, and he was caught and prosecuted, and he was given a sentence of probation and prison. And the Colorado Supreme Court has determined that you have to pick one or the other, but probation is inconsistent with prison. So the judge trying to lengthen the amount of time that he would have this person under judicial control gave him a prison sentence, and then he was going to have a period of 5 years, I believe, of parole by statute. And the judge tacked on another 7 or 8 years of probation to run consecutive. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. And this has the potential to free a lot of people who got those type of sentences. Some of the jurisdictions in Colorado were not doing that, but several were, and the larger metro areas were doing that. So people may be able to final out their sentences, because this is the end of the line for this case. There's nowhere else to take this. There's not a federal issue whatsoever. So there's no cert petition on this. The Colorado court has spoken. And
can you, understanding this, I received a split sentence of 22-6. Is that what this is? Cause that had prison and probation.
Yeah. I was saying that I had to hand this off to Ashley to take a look at. So we're going to analyze and see, but I don't know the Georgia scheme well enough to say if this is the same situation.
And I'm only using that is that the situation that they're describing that they found to be unconstitutional? And I'm not saying it's unconstitutional here. I'm trying to understand it for me, that sounds like the same thing.
Well, except for they did it by the counts there. They gave him a prison sentence on some of the counts, and then they gave him a probated sentence on the other counts because he had multiple counts. So they stacked consecutive sentences so that they would have a prison sentence and a probation sentence. I don't know if that's what they did in your case.
Okay.
They specifically sentenced him to prison on some of the counts, and they specifically sentenced him to probation. Colorado law is clear that if a person's put on probation, they can be sent sentenced to no more than 90 days of work release as a condition of probation. But probation and prison are for two different purposes. So for them, the judge was trying to invent a mechanism through the sentencing to have a greater amount of time to control this person to try to get some of the band's $59,000 of restitution back. And he failed because the court said you don't get to invent your own sentencing scheme. You have to follow the one that the legislature enacted.
Right. Yes.
And it says the plain language of the probation statute leads us to conclude that a court may not impose sentences to both imprisonment and probation for multiple offenses in the same case. To start the determination that probation is an appropriate sentence for a defendant necessarily requires a coordinate determination that prison is not appropriate. So they're saying that that's an inconsistent thing to determine. So the probation statute gives courts guidance and discretion in choosing to grant probation. However, it requires a choice between prison and probation. The legislature intended to allow courts to choose only one or the other. Probation is an alternative to prison. And that's what he argued, and he prevailed.
Interesting.
It says allowing a trial court, in effect, and I've highlighted this, these parts I'm reading, to increase the time of post-incarceration supervision ignores the fact that the legislature determined the proper length of time for a defendant's post-incarceration supervision when it crafted mandatory periods of parole. So in other words, regardless of the number of counts in a multi-count case, a defendant is only subject to one period of parole. And he cannot increase that period of post-prison supervision by stacking the consecutive period of probation.
Hmm. And then from the Ashley side and poking at Georgia, I mean, what kind of angle, you've read the statute, what kind of angle do you think there is to compare?
I haven't read the Georgia statute.
I don't know how
the sentencing scheme works in Georgia.
Anything else about this case that you want to touch on?
It says that there's clear direction that the legislature never intended for the court to have discretion to impose a period of confinement longer than 90 days or up to 2 years for work release when also sentencing a defendant to probation. The legislature's use of the term mandatory shall means that it intended for the sentence of probation to begin immediately. Hence, the legislature did not intend for courts to enter an order granting probation to run consecutively to a sentence of imprisonment. So a lot of folks in Colorado may be cut off supervision because their sentences may in fact be illegal.
That's crazy. And I would have to think, I've run into so many people that would say, well, they sentenced me, it's an illegal sentence, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, nothing gets done about it, possibly is an illegal sentence. So here you got a bunch of Joes over in Colorado saying that their sentence was illegal, and yeah, maybe it actually is illegal.
It may very well, in fact, it is.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, everybody who fits within this fact pattern that had a consecutive sentence of probation, they may be able to go to the probation officer and say, buddy, been nice knowing you. So, now, I'm not advising you to do that, of course, without a legal opinion from qualified counsel. But I'm saying it may be that people can go down and tell their PO, I'm about done with your kind.
Yes, that goes over well when you say your kind to the people with the guns and tasers.
Righty.
All right, let's move over to Vice News, which I don't think we've ever done Vice News before. This $2 test identified bird shit as cocaine. Forgive me for cussing. Cops keep using it to arrest people. This is all kinds of fun, Larry, that we always talk about the bond situations. This is how you could end up on bond and lose everything for something you didn't do. They said that donut crumbs also once tested positive for meth. I really like donuts, and I certainly wouldn't want my handlers to come here and go, oh, your glazed donut crumbs look like meth. And they test and they go, oh, that's meth. And my probation gets violated for me eating a donut.
Well, now, you know, Andy, that the POs are pure as the wind-driven snow, and they would never do that on a junk test. So we're having a conversation that is just so ridiculous because POs are so pure.
I would strongly encourage anyone to check out the show notes and find this article from Vice and watch the little video where they actually, the guy stands up there and he shakes the sample tube and he like says, I'm collecting air. And he just moves the thing up and down a few times to collect air, puts the lid on it, puts the substance in it, whatever, to make the test. And it tested positive for something just by using air.
I had that experience here. Lawyers have put these low-cost, but low-budget tests that they use. And here, my state's really crazy about testing everybody. They don't uniquely tailor the drug testing to a perceived individual's use of have a be 50 years old and never have touched any drugs, and they're going to drug test you here. So they keep the cost down, and we have routinely have people who question the validity of their test because they know what I've advised when we were taking private pay cases. I always advise people, this costs a little bit of money, not everybody can afford it, but I always advise people to do an independent drug test the same day that they get drug tested. So, for example, if you have a drug call-in hotline number that you have to call in for a random analysis, mm-hmm. Well, they generally give you a few hours to get there. If your number comes up, you have to get there before the day's over, right? Or before a certain period of time passes after your numbers come up.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, you go to your own lab and have your own drug test done the same day.
Right.
And you do that before you go to the probation office. Because then what they would have to do is they would have to put forth a theory that between the time you left your drug test lab, that you used drugs on the way to the probation office to be drug tested.
Yes. And that sounds legit. And what's the problem?
We've actually canned some of their violations. We had a client that was so crispy, whispering clean, and he had the financial wherewithal to pay for an independent test every time. And we accumulated a year and a half worth of independent tests, and then magically he failed. And they were getting ready to arrest him. He said, I don't think you ought to do that. And they said, why is that? And he said, well, because I took a test on the way in here. And they said, you did what? He said, I took a test on the way down here. And they said, why'd you do that? He said, just in case something like this should happen. He said, there's an independent sample of my urine at another lab that was taken right before I got here. And he said, so we're going to compare the urine with your urine and see what the independent lab says if you go forward with the rest of me trying to violate me. And of all the years of experience, he's the first one I've ever seen that they let go.
Hmm.
They said, all righty then. And they were really irritated that he was running his own independent testing scheme.
Jen in chat says that would make way too much sense. But, you know, those tests, I was having some blood work done every couple months, and they would always kick me back for a couple $100 bill.
They're a lot less than that.
Yeah, but still, you know, if you've got to fork out something like $50, maybe?
35 to 50 bucks, yeah.
And they're going to call you something every month or every couple months to do this? You know, that's not like an insurmountable amount of money, but jeepers.
However often your number comes up. Well, I guess it would. I proclaim that it's not the solution for everybody because some people don't have the $40 or whatever the test would cost in their area, and they may not have proximity to lab. If you live out in the boonies, and you may not have easy access to a lab if your probation office is out in the boonies.
True.
But those who live in urban areas, you probably have multiple labs that you could go to do a test. They do it for employers all the time.
Yeah.
And you just get your lawyer to set up an account with that lab where that they do supervise. It has to mimic the way the probation office would do it so the account has to be set up for supervised drug tests, not where you can go in and tamper with it. And then the lab technician certifies on the drug test that it was collected in his or her presence, depending on the gender. And you have that to shove in their face when they violate you, when they try to violate you.
And then for our final article, this is Inquirer.com. Living in fear, probation is meant to keep people out of jail, but intense monitoring leaves tens of thousands across the state at risk of incarceration. Long, long, long article, but highlights a particular individual who, once he got put out on probation, the amount of challenges and struggles with dealing with the anklet monitor thingamabobber and getting jobs. And he even describes in there that he was going to get a job just on the other side of the state. I don't, you know, it wasn't very far. This individual's in Philadelphia, but it was in a decent distant county, but not a huge distance. And the probation officer was like, no, sorry, we don't want you to go there. And so here probation is actually restricting this guy from any level of coming up. And you know, it's a good read, well written, and but super huge problems with all of this criminal stuff that we have to put up with.
As it has some good statistics in there. This, I think, this is the one where I got the article, the data about crime dropping, and about the.
They said it was like 50% since 1980 or something like that.
Yes, and then the number of probation violations, the number of people in prison has quintupled.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
the number of people in supervision. It was all of this article here, so that's what I would encourage people to read it for. Those who believe that crime has been going up all these years, and But more specifically to the point of the article is that probation used to be, if you could swing probation for your client, particularly when they had a solid case, it was considered a win because probation was rehabilitative. And the intent was to try to convince the person there's a different way to go through life. But now probation is an I got you moment. So you get the plea and it's a ticket to prison because the supervision is set up with such rigidity and so many do's and don'ts. And then with all the high-tech monitoring and the cost associated with that and all the alarm bells that go off that require you to go outside and push buttons and stay in touch with the cloud, that you end up with violations that didn't exist 10 years ago, 15 years ago. These violations didn't exist because the technology wasn't there. So we have more and more people being violated for tech problems that you know, you're in your high-tech world about how great technology is. A lot of the violations are due to tech failures.
Yes, absolutely. So definitely give this article a look. And they even also profile Larry Krasner about midway through about reducing the number of people that get locked up for these incredibly low level offenses and even moving on up the ladder from there. As you said, the crime rate has come down, yet the number of people are locked up is so much greater. So we're justifying the existence of law enforcement and prisons, even though, in spite of the fact that crime has gone down. So we've just made things more illegal.
Well, Andy, I don't believe those statistics for a minute. All that is just poppycock. Everybody knows crime is through the roof. Everybody knows that.
I don't know. Like, dude, that dude's head started spinning when you said that at the conference. I don't think that's reality, though. But that's what's portrayed on certain media outlets. I'm not sure. The ones that I follow don't do that. I can sort of think of one of them that sort of portrays the whole world as burning down if you pay attention to it long enough.
Early in the article, it says, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, 69%, which is roughly 2/3 of those completing probation did so successfully in 1990, compared with just half in 2016. And it says Pennsylvania counties have largely mirrored the national trend over mounting violations. Philadelphia used 80% more issued 80% more probation warrants in 2017 than it did in 15 years earlier. And so that tells you what's happening. Technical violations can run the gamut of so many things.
Certainly.
Because of how much tougher probation has become. Technology has made probation a lot more complicated to comply with.
Yes, without a doubt. They have all the different devices and apparatus to watch you. You've heard about the thing in Georgia where they've given you an app to install on your phone and they send you a link and you do like a live stream video conference with your handler. I'm kind of weirded out by this one.
So, yes, well, I like this one. One condition a judge added to her 12-year sentence talking about one of these people, not to hang around with bad people.
Yes. Got to watch out for the baddies. They also covered in the article, Larry, they were talking about the number of people that are on supervision of some kind. And, you know, don't hang out with those people, but you could be working side by side with them. And with so many people on supervision or that have had felonies, you could just be hanging out at a coffee shop, having lunch with somebody that you met at work, and they could also be a felon. And what are you supposed to do? Go say, "Hi, would you like to be friends? I'm sorry, are you a felon? Oh, sorry, we can't be friends."
Well, that sounds reasonable to me. Not only that, you should probably take their prints and run them back to the local fingerprint and have them check for a background and pay for the FBI background. But that's silly. The association is intended to be a case. Just one of our supporters in the state here, he hired someone to work for him, and the apparatus told him that he couldn't do it, that they couldn't work with each other, and the youngster had enough resources. He took it to the judge that sentenced him, and they got a judicial override saying that he could work there, because that's kind of the whole point of probation, is try to have people with jobs and to rebuild their lives. And I told the employer, I said, they're going to be gunning for both of you now. I said, you've both irritated them because you've got a judge to do something. They're not going to like that.
Yeah. Larry, that's all I got. What else do you got?
Oh, I think we should probably, in view of the technical glitches, we should probably try to wrap it up.
Yes, without a doubt. Hey, before we go, though, I want to make an announcement. Like, you know, next week is kind of a significant milestone. If you are listening to this podcast, maybe there are special events that are going to occur next week. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's a secret. Don't tell Larry. There, we can go on now.
Well, we do want to promote the Halloween event that's going to be happening on Thursday night for everyone who's listening to this podcast should join. And how do they join in that marathon?
Definitely go to Narsol and find the publication, but you could stream it on YouTube, which would be youtube.com/Narsol. That'll get you close enough there to find it. And then there's obviously a phone number that you could call in. And that's going to be Wednesday night starting at like noon or some crazy number like that and running till midnight. What's the time frame?
I thought Halloween was Thursday. Is it Wednesday?
No, it's Thursday. I'm sorry. I misspoke. So it's Thursday. My bad. Thursday, yeah. And it starts at what time?
We're going to start at 5 Eastern, and we're going to be doing a cop watch hotline. We're intended to watch the cops, and we're wanting real lifetime in-time reports as close as to possible to when they're trying to barge in your home or when you have to go turn yourself in for those who have to go sit in a particular location. We want you to call in and tell us they're taking my phone away from me, whatever was going on. So we're trying to be geared up for real live reports that are put on the air immediately, and hopefully there are no tech glitches. But we think we've got that tested. Brenda and I tested that. A couple of us tested that the other night.
Okay,
it seems like it's going to work. But we're wanting to, and we have a group of attorneys that are going to be standing by to give advice related to whatever is happening. And we're going to be taking names and phone numbers and jurisdiction information to possibly follow up, depending on what's really over the top, for possible legal action. The cops need to be on notice that your day of having unfettered access to do whatever you want to, those days are ending. There are people organizing to come after you, and you're going to have to follow the law, and you can't invent and make the law, and you can't exceed the law. And so that's what Narsol's trying to do, along with the corporation. Axel's going to be with us on this one for this event to try to broaden the audience and also the scope of legal expertise we have on the call.
All right. Excellent. And that runs from like 5 to 11, I think, is the time?
It's going to be a 6-hour total, and nobody's going to listen to the entire 6 hours. We understand
except
that.
Except for me.
Like any other long show. But right now, it looks like we may divide it up between the East and West, and Axel may have it for 3 hours, and we may have it. We're still working out the details
sure.
of how we're going to divide the time, but it'll be fun. And I know that the promotional spots are flooding in. I think you've got like 26 of them already, right?
Absolutely.
And we'll have some prize contests. It'll be fun. Everybody should join us that listen to the podcast.
Awesome. Sounds great. Larry, let's run through this real quick. Registrymatters.co, 747-227-4477, and email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, our favorite way, our best way, our patrons, our favorite special people, patreon.com/registrymatters. And that's all I got.
Thanks for having me.
I will try to have you again if you will clear your schedule next week, and we will do it next week. Have a great night, Larry.